The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, and are not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of the station.
Hello, and welcome to Pearl on Politics. The second Saturday of each month, Professor David Pearl will host his show, Pearl on Politics. Hello, Professor Pearl.
Hello, Pamela.
And so in the studio today, we have a guest. And so, Professor Pearl, did you want to introduce our guest or guests?
Absolutely. So today we are joined with my engineer, Pamela Spado. We are joined in studio by John Whitmer, labor historian, non-parallel. We're joined by Randy Compton, environmental activist, also non-parallel. And if that's even the right phraseology, I don't know, maybe non-parallel is a parallel line. Unparalleled, there we go. In any case, today's episode of Pearl on Politics will highlight labor and environmental issues. And I wanted to start the program not discussing labor in America, but looking at the tiny hermit kingdom of North Korea. I was watching Dutch documentarian Peter Flowery's movie, North Korea, A Day in the Life, the other week. And in this movie, Peter gives us a glimpse into the daily life of a North Korean factory worker. One of the creepiest scenes, among many creepy scenes, showed this factory worker at a meeting where she was forced to tell the manager of her factory all those areas that she had apparently failed in her duties to perform on that given day. In addition, the workers were asked to share what the workers next to them had failed at during that given day. What struck me about this horrible situation, this situation where the workers were forced to effectively rat on their fellow workers for what purposes you can only imagine, is that North Korea is a country without the kind of labor rights that we have here in the States, the kind of hard-fought and hard-won battles that we now seem to enjoy and take for granted. The North Koreans have never seen. Their lives are of, well, ones of abject horror, ones of complete usury. And this is where I wanted to bring Dr. John Whitmer into the conversation. John is a labor historian, a professor at Shasta College, perhaps the North State's greatest historian dealing with labor, but also more to the fact, maybe the North State's only labor historian. That being said, my question has something to do with the difference between the hermit kingdom of North Korea, the horrible conditions that these factory workers work under, and our own American experience. John, how did the labor movement begin here? And is there perhaps a likelihood or an inevitability that we will see a nascent labor movement in a place like North Korea in the future?
Those are all very good questions. First of all, thank you for having me.
And you're welcome.
I don't know about the accolades, but certainly I am interested in history, and probably my interest in history started with just caring about people and people's issues. And of course, work and livelihood is something very important. But of course, labor history is as old as workers are, and there has always been work. It's been defined differently, but we can go back on this continent to 5000 BCE and see one of the major revolutions, and that would be the agricultural revolution. And that agricultural revolution, when people are starting to farm more they are hunting and gathering, are going to start changing work cultures. And for most indigenous peoples, it was women who did the farming. And of course, when the Europeans came, primarily the British, the husbands, they were the ones who did the husbandries. And so there were a lot of cultural clashes there. But I bring this point up to say is that labor history is as old as people are. And of course, slavery started in this country with indentured servants. The first African indentured servants came to Jamestown in 1613. So a lot of people don't think of slavery as a labor system as well. And when you do include slavery as a labor system in our country, we can see that the United States history of labor is one of the most violent in the country.
You know, so, I wonder, when we're talking about this transition from the field effectively to the cities, to the factories, you know, people tend to forget that what these workers encountered was a scene of Dickensian horror, an exploitive workplace, 7-day work a week, child labor, all of the hallmarks of, you know, some horrible dystopian novel. And, you know, while the history of labor is clearly goes back to time immemorial, when I think of labor, I think of this initial movement into the industrialized workforce.
Indeed, and much of labor history has focused on industrial issues, or it's often called pork chop unionism, which is wages, hours, and working conditions. And that has a lot more to do with the fact that the first labor historian, John R. Commons, who was a professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin, it was a governor, Robert LaFollette, who walked down State Street to the Wisconsin campus and said, "Hey, I want to introduce some labor laws. Can you do some research?" So the first labor historian focused on wages, hours, and working conditions because that was his background for economics. Hmm. But there are new labor historians, and that's what I was trained at, who emphasize more of the human or cultural element of it, of labor and labor movements.
Let's take a let's go with that. What do you mean by the cultural elements of labor?
So with social movements, and that would be a social movement would be defined as disparate people, disparate organization coming together with a common goal. There's often in its wake a movement culture. So culture is defined by one of our colleagues, Dr. James Tate, an anthropologist, as a characteristic of a particular people at a particular place and time. And so if workers are working together, there is going to be a culture. And you can look at this from a larger perspective and look at a labor movement and a movement culture then, or you can look at specifically a workplace and look at a work culture. And workers influence these in many different ways. So at the workplace, for example, there is a concept known as stints, and that means little work rules that people have. And so I'm sure in your listening audience, there are some workers who have been working hard at their first day or week at work, and they have had someone come up and tap them on their shoulder and say, "You're working a little bit too fast. You need to slow down for the rest of us." That's workers influencing a work stint. And that, you know, that's just an example of a work culture. But when there is people and they are, you know, whether working in the workplace or after the workplace, getting together to improve their lives, then there's going to be culture.
This is curious to me, because that scene from our Dutch documentarian friend highlighted perhaps what you would call stints, what you might call a workplace norm, where people are effectively taught and probably told to effectively malign their fellow workers. In a situation where the workers have more control of their workspace, you wouldn't have a concern about one person working too fast or too slow. Instead, you'd have a unified goal, a productivity goal, something along those lines. But what I always find encouraging, you're talking about sort of workplace norms, but we find more and more, regardless of the vocation, more and more very different workplaces joining the unionized workforce, not just industrial workers, not just education workers or state sector workers. I mean, just yesterday, we saw the nurses, for example, at the Shasta Regional Hospital vote to join the AFL-CIO, the California Nurses Association. Perhaps there is some hope for not only the United States, but also maybe for our friends in North Korea in this idea that we'll develop norms that everyone can adopt.
certainly you're going to have workers being influenced beyond political borders, beyond geographical borders. Certainly the United States labor movement was influenced by people coming from many different continents, whether it's Asia or Europe or South America. When I'm thinking of, comparing the United States and its labor policy to other countries, I immediately think of Mexico. And Mexico adopted the right for workers to organize several decades before the United States did. So in 1917, towards the end of the Mexican Revolution, Mexican people gave themselves the right to organize and be part of labor unions. It wasn't until 1935, with the National Labor Relations Act, otherwise known as the Wagner Act, that workers in the United States had the right to organize. So sometimes comparing the United States as being more progressive isn't always the case, because again, as I hinted earlier, the United States has had a bloody labor history. There have been lots of labor wars. There have been lots of fights from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, to the Monongahela Valley, to West Virginia. Mm-hmm. There have been lots of battles, and especially when you see slavery as a labor system, which it fundamentally was.
Professor Whitmer, I'd like to ask you a question about that too. I was thinking when you earlier talked about the slavery, the peculiar institution of slavery, and a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, in my opinion, the United States was built on the backs of people of color. I mean, in the South, the plantations, having free labor was enabled them to make and acquire money and lots of money. And I think that sometimes we don't recognize that all of the input from people of the enslaved people. And then jumping ahead a bit to Cesar Chavez, when we talk about the violence of it, I mean, obviously there was violence in slavery, horrific violence to use their bodies to produce money for the plantation owners. But then with Cesar Chavez, it was remarkable, and I didn't know whether you were going to touch on that. I mean, what the Mexican workers in the fields went through for the corporations in the United States.
Absolutely. That's another great example of immigration. And again, I think, the largest forced migration in world history would be African slavery. And but certainly, if we look at why the United States is so diverse, for example, one out of every five Americans can trace their roots through Ellis Island, which was just one port of call. You can see that many of the reasons why they're coming are for economic improvement, for labor. There's a promise of jobs. So scholars often talk about, with immigration, the push and pull effect. So there is something that's pushing an emigre out of their original land, and there's something pulling them to their new land. And so jobs were advertised. Dr. Pearl and I know that when you live in Idaho, you tend to elongate those O's. A lot of people don't realize the reason why that is the case in many northern states is because the Great Northern Railroad targeted specifically Scandinavian farmers to come. And so you have with the use of umlauts and so forth, the elongated O's, and it's still part of our culture today. That is a phenomenon of immigration, but it's also a phenomenon of work and the people that were performing those work.
And I think the descendants of people from Scandinavia were very similar to those who came from Mexico and all points south. In fact, if we look at, Pamela, you mentioned Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. For those of our audience that are unfamiliar with the case, in the 1980s, a little bit of sort of technological background, it was very expensive to effectively spray your fields at night. And in order to save a few dollars, California's grape growers primarily sprayed their fields during the day, particularly when men, women, and sometimes children were out picking their food and or their grapes and attending to the plants. Well, everything that you'd expect to happen did. Women who were pregnant gave birth to individuals with birth defects. You had all kinds of negative health outcomes, cancer, all of these horrible products, which we'll talk to Randy about maybe in a little bit. these products that necessarily were not safe for the workers to be sprayed with. And, you know, the demands of the United Farm Workers, this organization of effectively migrant laborers, were fairly mundane. You know, they wanted a decent wage. They wanted to be able to pick fruit and vegetables without being sprayed with chemicals. And in order to accomplish this, they called for a rather successful boycott of table grapes and other grape products. And I say successful in the fact that it probably caused sales of grape products to not fall off a cliff, but to be hindered by just enough to make it cost effective for the owners of these fields to spray at night and to pay them a little bit more. And we're not talking about people earning a massive wage. We're not talking about people living the high life, but just to live in what Mr. Chavez called poverty with dignity was their goal, rather than an abject squalor having all these horrible health outcomes.
And Professor Pearl, could I ask you one other question about that? And at that time that Cesar Chavez and the workers were talking, and they were telling the corporations and the people that hired them of all of these things that were happening to them that were negative, that were physical, that where they would get sick, but they weren't being believed by the public, because the media was doing whatever it was doing at that time, supporting the business owners. But if we jump up until today, and if we look at glyphosate in Roundup, I mean, there are massive lawsuits going on right now for workers in the field, you know, getting sprayed or getting in contact with really intensely poisonous substances. Yeah. And it's just amazing what people in the fields go through. And I just don't quite understand how the corporations or the businesses, you know, can kind of sleep at night knowing that these toxic substances are negatively impacting people's health. But this brings in the union, does it not? I mean, in terms of safety?
I think my impression is that it's much, much worse than that. Right? We're talking about institutions that are worried about the bottom line rather than about the health of either their workers or their customers.
Certainly, we talked about, again, the difference between trade unions that tend to focus on wages, hours, and working conditions, and the other form of unions are industrial unions, and they tend to be the ones that are looking at social movements. Certainly, for example, in the 1980s, some politicians, Ronald Reagan, for example, was able to successfully use a wedge issue of the environment versus labor. So jobs versus trees. And I grew up in Northern California, and of course the spotted owl was the big issue. So you either save the lumber industry or you save the spotted owl. And I think with the Clinton administration and then moving into the 21st century, starting to focus on more issues of green jobs. So there was more overlap between the environmental movement and the labor movement. But a lot of this also has to do with workplace and workplace safety. So it's no coincidence that 1970 was not only the Earth Day, but also the formation of OSHA, the Occupational Safety Health Administration and Act, and so that you are protecting workers at their workplace. And so I think both of you are getting at the fact that, which is where my interest and my interest in labor history is more of the human element and less of the economics and political element of a workers and work culture.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And we'll talk about that here in a moment, but we do need to break for a station identification. This is KKRN Community Radio, 88.5 FM, Bella Vista, Round Mountain. We are volunteer supported. You are listening to Pearl on Politics. I am Dr. David Pearl. We are discussing labor and environmental issues. In the studio with me is Randy Compton, environmental activist, and John Whitmer, labor historian. Now, let's continue our discussion about labor and try to equate this to the false dichotomy of, between jobs and the environment. And maybe bring a Randy in here as well. My general impression is that this is not an either-or issue, that you can have a robust economy and have basic protections for for our shared environment. unfortunately, and this is the problem in economics, is when you start to discuss the bottom line, shared costs are called externalities. Externalities are basically something that isn't measured, but that has an effect from an economic output. For example, if I can make $100 for every single car that I sell, and the purchaser of the car can save $50 by purchasing my car, well, this is a decent transaction as far as the economics discipline is concerned. However, it produces the unwanted externality of more CO2 being emitted into our shared environment. There is no cost associated with this long-term, what could amount to a catastrophic end. Randy, I wonder if you might want to talk a little bit about the problems that we face. Now, we've been talking about labor, about migrant farm workers, and Pamela mentioned that you were interested in agriculture and the problems of not mass agriculture, but industrial waste, industrial output, and these seed products like Roundup and these pesticides that seemingly cause as much harm as they do, keeping aphids away from the local corn or whatever you're growing. I wonder if there might be a better solution. How can we avoid the kind of catastrophic pitfalls that we seem to be headed toward, the kind of precipice of disaster, the kind of end to the human race that might come from a large amount of these externalities colliding?
Well, I'm a lifelong resident here of Round Mountain, and I've grown up in the timber industry at a time when the whole culture and economy of this area was pretty much based on logging.
Yeah.
And in that amount of time, say 60 years, our biosphere, our forests have been reduced to what you can view now on Google Earth. It's a maze of tree farms and barren ground. And I just can't see how anybody expects that to continue.
Yeah.
And not only has that happened here, but it's happening globally.
Yeah.
And Randy, you're very well aware, because we've had conversations about this, as Professor Pearl was talking about, in terms of herbicides and pesticides. A lot of people think logging is just a clean kind of endeavor, but there's a soil problem, there's the herbicide problem, there's the runoff problem in the water. Is there not that there's a lot of contamination that happens?
Well, the timber companies get to self-monitor what takes place on their property in regards to herbicides. But there are ranchers that I know that have told about their irrigation ditches, everything dying in their ditches after they've clear cut, because the initial act of a clear cut is to mark it and then spray it with herbicides to virtually sterilize the area. And then they come back with machinery and they grind it down. It's like giant lawnmowers. They grind it up, chip it, follow the big timber and haul it off. And when they're done, they rip it and replant it with hybrid trees.
Now, what gets me is this is a seemingly short-term solution. And me and John Whitmer, who's sitting beside me, and myself, we're from northern Idaho. And throughout northern Idaho, you find the same thing, right? Sort of a clear-cut area, replanting with smaller trees and trees further apart as to prevent future wildfires. That's sort of the pretext, right? The obvious response is that these companies go through, companies like Weyerhaeuser will go through and tear down a forest, replant it and sit on the land for a long, long period of time. This is a short-term, this is effectively a short-term gain, right?
And it's also a monoculture that is being replanted versus the diversity of all the different kinds of trees and growth that you had in there.
I worry about this as well. We're talking about a very fragile ecosystem. But when Randy talks about these companies self-monitoring, it raises all kinds of alarm bells. And as maybe John can speak to this, but when we're talking about institutions or businesses self-monitoring, effectively we're talking about a lack of accountability. And that seems to be throughout the concept that is pronounced throughout the labor history.
Certainly a lack of accountability, perhaps morally or legally, but certainly what we have emphasized in American culture is the bottom line or the economic. So when you say accountability, that is really where I think you can begin to have a conversation. And I think that's what's most exciting to me about academia right now is the emergence of sustainability as an area of study. And so sustainability, most people think of in environmental terms, but it's not just that. Sustainability in keeping a social movement going, labor movement going, sustainability keeping a business going. And so I think that is what has come to the attention of a lot of people is if you cut down all the trees, then you have no more work. So you need to make sure that there's an invested interest in all people, you know, those who are the workers and those who are living in the area and the workplaces or surrounding the workplaces, that sustainability is an important issue. And when you do that, then you can bring in not only economic issues, but environmental issues as well.
The problem, of course, being that it is often framed as a jobs versus clear-cut mentality versus jobs versus the environment, I should say. We're going to take a quick break here and then return.
And we'll be right back.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see. If ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we as we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on the sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense. It contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me How much can she take? How much can she give?
And welcome back to Dig This, Pearl on Politics.
And we're back. This is Dr. David Pearl. You're listening to Pearl on Politics. We are back with Randy Compton and John Whitmer. Now, we were talking about the catastrophic short-term thinking that often accompanies environmental decision-making. And we were talking about labor and sort of the intersection of sustainability and the sustainability of the workplace. And I think this is a very curious subject because obviously when you think about sustainability, you think about maintaining decent agricultural products, processes. You think about protecting trees. You think about all manner of environmental safeguards. You don't necessarily think about protecting labor. You don't think about protecting the workplace itself. And this is why I think it's a false dichotomy to suggest that one needs to either be for labor or for the environment. Theoretically, you should be able to protect both. Dr. Whitmer, I wonder if you can't talk for a moment about the sustainability. You talked about the sustainability of labor and of movements. What do you mean by the sustainability of labor?
Certainly, the labor movement has ups and downs. Right now, in the private sector, the labor movement is a fraction of the total number of workers. However, in the public sector, those unions are much stronger, a higher percentage. So certainly that is a concern for workers, and that is, you know, a lot of what labor unions do is organize and educate, as well as put things into action. So for the labor movement, sustainability means how do we get people to continue to participate within the labor movement.
Let me ask you, why is it so difficult for the private sector to maintain robust union activity? And why is it so much easier, or seemingly easier, for public sector unions to develop and operate here in the States?
Well, there's a long history of associating unions with communism, left-leaning agitators, using xenophobia, seeing workers as foreigners. So when you say that you're part of a labor union, often people see you as being a lefty or something like that. Mm. Also, within the public and private sphere, it is seen that the public working for the government is a more safe, better benefits, but it's not as lucrative. And working for the private companies is seen as being a more lucrative effort. But you really have to get back to labor law, get back to Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which severely limited the Wagner Act that I mentioned earlier of 1935. It also allowed right-to-work states where workers in a right-to-work state do not have as many rights as workers who are part of
Real quick, this idea of the, quote, right-to-work state, it's misnamed, mislabeled.
Yes.
It's purposely mislabeled and effectively make it very difficult for unions to organize. This is why you see more union activity, particularly north of the Mason-Dixon line, than you do in the southern states, and the so-called right-to-work states. And if you could see me, I'm doing sort of an air quotes that doesn't translate well onto the radio.
The other thing I want to talk about sustainability, and again, getting back to environmental issues, is, for example, here in Redding. Redding is the second sunniest city, has the second most sunny days outside of Phoenix. And so there has, because it is, there's so much sun, it would make sense to have more solar panels. And it would also make sense if there were more opportunities for workers to learn the skills that are necessary to install the solar panels, keep them running, and so forth. And so that, to me, is also an issue of sustainability. And it has to come from both sides, not only the workers themselves and finding new jobs, but also for policymakers. For example, you know, Shasta College, if the community members are interested enough, they could come forth to Shasta College and say, why don't we have a certificate on installing solar panels?
Yeah, Yeah, and these types of vocational programs would be helpful, and they seem to be the norm. They seem to be the norm moving forward. I know that my sister and my brother-in-law just installed these solar panels on their roof, and he happens to be an electrician and was able to handle it himself. But assuming the average person who's not an electrician and not maybe handy wants to set these the sun to work for them, certainly having somebody trained to build these units and install them would be productive for any community. Now, there's a side note to this in that the rare earth minerals needed for solar power generation are somewhat costly to the environment in other areas. So when you extract some of these rare earth minerals through strip mining processes, you get the inevitable environmental degradation. This is, of course, half a world away where people generally at a site, at a mine, comes into play, and something we should think about as well.
And I think it's really important, as everyone has mentioned here, that this is not an either-or situation. It reminds me of America, love it or leave it. You know, it's like, well, I can criticize or I can have input. That doesn't mean it's just black or white. And the idea of it's environment or jobs just doesn't make sense to me. But just as you said, there can be green jobs. There can be sustainable jobs that people can be doing. And what Professor Whitmer mentioned about the right to work for less, I mean, that is so incredible, because I think there has been a concerted effort to bust unions, to get rid of unions, to reduce unions. Mm-hmm. And so a right to work for less, I wonder, you know, if I said, okay, I'll work for $2 an hour. I mean, is that a right to work for less? You know, at least I'm making $2 an hour. It seems insanity to me.
It's a lot worse than that, because if you suggest that, you might be, as John said, labeled a communist or labeled an agitator. We have a history of red baiting. I mean,
yes,
this travels into the political world as well. Yes. I remember during the 2016 election, as Bernie Sanders supporters were labeled as Russian agitators, as misogynists, as, quote, Bernie bros, for daring to oppose a candidate who seemingly had no qualifications, but also very little in the way of progressive political qualifications. And the charge is one of you're with the other. You're a communist, a leftist, an agitator. This is a common thread throughout American society in terms of labor. This is not unique to labor, I should say. In fact, we see it in all walks of life. Try to make waves, you're suddenly, you know, Vladimir Lenin himself. You know, you try to sue for a better workplace, better working conditions, and you are the reincarnate of Joseph Stalin.
My favorite example of that is often May Day is seen as being a foreign holiday, but May 1st was declared in 1886 the International 8-Hour Workday. And that started in the United States by the Knights of Labor, and then the AFL picked up on this as well. It eventually led to workers at the McCormick Wheat Factory being locked out, and it led to some counter-protest and, unfortunately, some violence, and this leads to the Haymarket Massacre. But throughout the world, they celebrate May 1st as the Labor Day. But here in the United States, we see that as a foreign holiday, and, of course, we celebrate Labor Day in the first weekend of September.
I'd always wondered why they moved our Labor Day from the internationally recognized date, and this makes a lot of sense. Thank you. Well, we are going to take a quick break for station identification. This is KKRN Community Radio, 88.5 FM, Bella Vista, Round Mountain. We are volunteer-supported. You are listening to Pearl on Politics. I am Professor David Pearl. We are discussing labor and environmental issues with John Whitmer and Randy Compton. Now, Pamela, do you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share with us before we head on out into the sunset?
Well, I was wondering, I had a question, and that is, to me, democracy and capitalism are antithetical to each other. And when we talk about unions, and as Professor Whitmer had suggested, that the idea is that these are communists, they're agitators, they're lefties, and yet I suppose from a capitalistic perspective, we're trying to always worry about the bottom line and how much profit can we make for the board is different from democracy, where it's about equality. It's about being fair. And it seems to me that that's what unions are about in terms of protecting labor and making a living wage, a decent wage, and being protected from toxic chemicals. Am I off base with that? I mean, it seems capitalism is really, really in contradiction to democracy, in my opinion.
I think our version of predatory capitalism, perhaps. I think that there are other versions. Now, you're talking about democracy as antithetical to capitalism, but there are other countries, our friends in Northern Europe, for example, where they practice a strong element of workplace democracy, where workers have a say. I just watched a film, in fact, about a worker co-op in Argentina, where workers not only have a say in as far as how much is produced, but also a say in their own wages. And these are just different models of capitalism. I don't think that you need to necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater as long as you introduce a workplace democracy.
Now, when we talk about cooperatives, and I really like that term, I also like Richard Wolff, and I guess he's considered an economist. Well, he's an economist, but maybe towards the left. But often when we talk about cooperatives, isn't that seen as not exactly, I mean, it's not like private industry with the typical kinds of structure, but it's more about people coming together and working and making decisions within that cooperative about what they want. And
if I could give a historical example, I mentioned the Knights of Labor in 1886 with the 8-hour workday. They were ones who believed in cooperation, and so they would form their own companies themselves and share that profit. It was, you could say, small C communist as an economic system. They didn't really see it as that such. They saw themselves as truly being American. And so I think when you talk about capitalism to democracy, capitalism is an economic system. Right. Democracy is a political system. And certainly there is some overlap, but they certainly are not mutually exclusive. But if you only focus on economic issues, and people will trump that as far as being the example of capitalism, I think then you forget about human issues. And the reason why the 8-hour workday was established was because of the 24-hour day. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of leisure. Mm-hmm. And in the 1919 steel strike in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, it was the bread and roses strike. You had women saying, yes, we want bread, food to eat, but we also want roses too. We want part of that good life as well. So if you focus just on economic issues, I think you lose the human side of people, of workers, of working class culture. And so if capitalism means just the bottom line, then I think, yes, you miss that fact. Another example would be that Martin Luther King Jr., of course, died in Memphis, Tennessee. What was he doing there? In 1968, it was for a garbage workers' strike. Mm-hmm. The majority of those garbage workers were African American. And, of course, the saying that Martin Luther King said is, great that you are able to go to a Woolworths and are free to purchase things, but if you have no money in your pocket, how free are you? So again, if we just look at pork chop unionisms, wages, hours, working conditions, we often forget the humanity, the roses too.
Yeah, and it's this work-life balance that I think we will leave on. Now, of course, I remember that Dr. King was similarly called a communist in his day, labeled as an agitator by many in the South. Listeners of this program will note that we've been fairly consistent in our support for labor, in our support for the environment, in our support for sustainability of all kinds. There's a reason why the country of Denmark ranks so highly in terms of life outcomes, in terms of what they call positive life outcomes, health, in terms of happiness, in terms of feelings of satisfaction. And that has to do with the kind of cooperation that they have, the kind of work-life balance that they strike with their employers, the kind of 8-8-8 hour split between sleeping and rest, between enjoyment and between labor that they seemingly have achieved. But alongside those impressive results come a rather constraining, from the point of economic growth, a rather constraining set of taxes, which is why in America, with its focus on perpetual and exponentiary growth, we have not adopted the kind of work-life balance that our friends in Northern Europe have. Any final thoughts?
I have a question, a very specific question, this is from an article about celebrating labor and Labor Day, and it's about taxi drivers in New York. And it said taxi drivers in New York are getting health care for the first time, and this was a couple of years ago. And so I guess I'm kind of wondering if we could just touch on what is the Uber? How is Uber? I mean, I'm hearing a lot of negative aspects about what Uber is doing in terms of the organized, unionized, let's say, taxi drivers. Can either of you speak to that?
I'd be happy to.
Okay,
so
good.
The model of employment when it comes to New York taxi cab drivers is as follows. A taxi cab ownership company purchases what they call a medallion. There are only a certain number of these medallions, maybe a couple thousand within the entire city. Each medallion entitles one car to drive a fare to and from a location. Now, because there's a scarcity of these medallions, and the board that controls the issuance of these medallions hasn't increased the number of medallions as the population has grown, it's made the cost to purchase one of these medallions from an already existing taxicab company rather expensive. And when a commodity is expensive, you can believe that they will pass on the cost of the certification, in this case the medallion, onto the consumer, making taxicab rides extremely expensive in a place like New York. Now you enter companies like Lyft or like Uber. They don't carry with them a medallion. They are essentially private contractors. Their model works like this. You have an individual with a car. They have some time on their hands. An application based on a mobile phone tells the driver of this car where a potential fare would be. They go and pick that person up, agree on terms. The person pays them and gets out of the car after the fare is complete. Well, the idea here is that there is no specific training. There is no limitation on how many Lyft or Uber drivers there could be. There's no artificial scarcity making sure that the cost is very low. But the actual fares, because they're very low, they don't allow often the Uber driver or the Lyft driver to make a very decent wage. This isn't always true. So for instance, the first couple of months that Uber or Lyft enter a new city or town, and there's only a few Uber or Lyft drivers charging marginally less than what the prevailing wage for a medallion-carrying taxicab company would charge, they are effectively making quite a bit of money. Their fare after fare after fare comes in, but the model is somewhat flawed in that as soon as people see money coming into somebody's hands without the ability, or well, without having to purchase a medallion, they move over to Uber, and then you have a preponderance of Uber and Lyft drivers. The cost inevitably goes down, and the money that these Uber and Lyft drivers bring in is much, much, much less than their medallion-carrying counterparts. In terms of labor, they've been against the introduction of both Uber and Lyft into multiple markets for this exact reason. Effectively, it's a way to cut down on the cost of labor. And they do it under the pretext of, we're here fighting against these silly medallions that are being sold at outrageous rates. But whenever you introduce scarcity into a market, you're also raising the price and the wage conditions of the people that engage in taxiing people around. I certainly support the taxi drivers who are probably correct in the assumption that these medallions do cost too much. They should probably introduce more. But I don't think that they should do away with the process entirely, and thus allowing what has been described by one economist as a race to the bottom. And when we're talking about taxi cabs, a race might seem like a weird imagery, but you get the idea. Eventually, we'll see very, very low fares, but also accompanying very, very low pay.
And I've yet to, in my experience, meet an Uber driver, which that was their only occupation. Mm-hmm. Usually it's their second or third job. I recently returned from Washington, D.C., and met a very well-dressed Uber driver who was a GS-13, which is a very good government salary. But living in Washington, D.C., he needed the extra money in order to, with a higher cost of living. And to bring this kind of maybe full circle, it's interesting that Martin Luther King Jr. got his start at the Montgomery bus boycott. Mm-hmm. And of course, that bus was owned by the city. And how many African Americans, especially elderly, got around was people would give them rides. And so the way that the city of Montgomery tried to break the strike was to make jitney services, which is what basically Uber is today, a jitney service, individual taxi cab drivers, to make that illegal so that you would have to be forced to be on the buses. But of course that ultimately failed, and Martin Luther King then becomes one of the most significant leaders of the civil rights movement.
And that is certainly true. And I'm so I guess in the final analysis here, or in our final comments, is there a way, well, it's a twofold question, is there a way to make the public more aware of the value of unions and the history of unions? And then the second part of that question would be, and I think it happened in Reading, downtown Reading, with by the Sundial Bridge and the hotel building and so forth, because it was pitting union against non-union workers, and I believe that it was the non-union workers that, you know, that got the job. How does that work? I mean, how do we protect the union and have the union be able to get the jobs that they need to get, rather than being what, undercut by not, I mean, does the company just say, okay, we want to hire non-union workers and that's what's going to happen because it's going to be cheaper for us?
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that we are all workers.
Yes.
We all
yes.
work, and we have different working conditions. And so, therefore, we do have a commonality. And so instead of seeing us as opposites, mm-hmm. and also understand that oftentimes with politics, it's easier to have these wedge issues like mm-hmm. we brought up with the environment versus jobs.
Right.
Or so that hopefully when you think of more commonalities instead of differences, that then we have more conversations. But I'm thinking of the five county central labor council who did try to make those Turtle Bay jobs, keep them to be union jobs. I think of their emphasis at Shasta College, for example, to have CTE or technical education. They're the ones that are saying, let's not just have pre-college courses, but let's have welding, let's have heavy mechanic. They are wanting to have these skilled jobs
yes.
that can provide good opportunities. So they are, to me, the five county central labor council is a great example of sustainability, where they are putting action into trying to create opportunities for the next generation.
I think that's true. And I think that there's also another rather unspoken truth here. And that is that unions themselves have been oftentimes maligned in popular culture, from film to just general banter you hear between your friends. This is to say they are thought of as something to fight against, that they're the bosses trying to take money out of your paycheck, when anything else could be true. These are groups that are literally organizing for the purpose of collective bargaining, for the purpose of raising people out of poverty and the malaise that comes from exploitation.
My favorite bumper sticker is, it says, the weekend, or excuse me, the labor movement, the folks who brought you the weekend.
Fantastic.
Yes, yes.
Well, Pamela, I think we've come to a close.
Well, okay, and I want to thank Professor Whitmer and Professor Pearl and Randy Compton, of course. And I do want to mention that next Saturday will be Music with a Message with Craig Boyer, and he will be focusing on the message of the future of labor in the USA, what it has been and what it may become. So what we're hearing here is we're having a show on labor, and we're going to be having some music and commentary on labor. And I think even Dig This Trump Watch was talking, Professor Pollack was talking a little bit about labor. So this is the month to do that and to appreciate all of our labor. And I think Professor Whitmer is correct that not pitting workers against workers. I mean, we're all trying to make a decent living, take care of our families, take care of ourselves. And
every day is Labor Day.
Okay.
Fantastic.
All right.
Fantastic.
And thank you so much, and thank you, audience. Bye-bye now.